Welcome everybody to tonight's bull session. We're doing a April, May for our last session for the spring. And we thought it'd be really good conversation now that we need to get out and start grazing here pretty soon about how to match our forage supply with our livestock demand. And I know personal experience, not having any experience with the pasture that we're going to be grazing this summer, it's been a challenge trying to figure out how many yearlings we can actually run without going out and being able to measure our grass. So I'm very excited about tonight, and I'm sure I'll learn a lot. And please, like, we have quite a few people on, so keep yourself muted if you don't have a question. And then if you have a question, just turn it back on again. But we also do record these so that we can save them on our website so you guys can view them and listen to them later. So give me about a week and a half sometimes to get that up on the internet or on the website. But so anyways, I guess we'll get going. And I didn't really talk about what order to go, but I guess I always go age before beauty. So who would that be?
Be you.
I think you're on, Roger. And then the other two fight over who's the beauty.
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood.
You meant beauty before age.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, but I should introduce our speakers. We do have Roger Enderlin, Bart Morris from Oxbow over in Missoula, and Wyatt Donald from Big Timber area as well, too. And Roger's from Big Timber. So I'll let you take it away, Roger. I don't know if you need any assistance from me, but if you do, let me know.
Okay, thanks. Appreciate it. So matching your forage with your livestock, or how many livestock you're guessing how many you're going to have. Is that kind of the main thing you're thinking about, Holly?
That is the main thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's something we do on an ongoing basis, is trying to make that estimate. There's certainly things that we can go back to some historical stuff, but like Holly, like you're talking, if you don't have historical information about a pasture or something or an area, it leaves you with making what I would call big picture predictions. And then there's a lot of things to think about as you're looking at that. Do you want to graze every acre? And I think you just start with the big picture questions of how much ground or how much land of what type do you have. And so I like to start with how many acres of what kind of ground, and that, or what the production potential is, meaning basically sparsely covered dry land, which might be 150 pounds an acre, up to sub-irrigated meadow type that might produce 3,000 pounds an acre of grazable forage, as far as getting to it, could even be 4,000, I'm sure, in some areas. But so I like to just break it first into those categories of about how many acres of each kind of ground there is. Improved pasture, probably it could be 1,500 to 2,000 pounds an acre. And a lot of native range can be around 750 to 1,000. Or it can be 300, depending on the average. And you got to extrapolate, because a lot of landscapes have coulees and a certain number of acres in there that are going to produce 1,000, 1,500 pounds an acre. And then there's the rest of it, other areas that are going to produce closer to the 200-300 pounds an acre. And I like to start with total production or total production estimates. And then decide from there how much do you want to use of that? And also what areas you might take your total acreage and just right off the top say, we're going to reduce that by 15 or 20%. If you're going to rest a portion of ground every 5 years, you'd have to take 20% of that acreage or that total production off. And then you decide which areas. But if you've got experience with looking at your grass and looking at your grazing, two things that I think are really important is one, and there's a, it goes back to the clippings and stuff that range people do. you take a square yard or a square meter, and this is based on a dry matter basis, and I do everything on a dry matter basis. And you take that square meter or square yard, and if you clipped it to the ground, and this would be like in the fall, you're starting out here in the spring, and you're really guessing because you're really not sure what your precipitation is going to be and how it's going to grow. But for instance, in the fall, you could clip that. What you had, if you were doing stockpile feed, you'd have your growth, and you clip that and dry it down. Normally it's dried down almost enough, especially if you're doing it in September and October or late September and October, to where it's really close to being enough, close enough to dry matter basis. You take and weigh that in grams, multiply that by 20, and that gives you your pounds per acre of dry matter. And as a rule of thumb, a big handful of dry matter, if you just grabbed out of a square yard area and you had a handful the size of a baseball, pretty compacted, not a base, a softball, actually, fairly compacted, that's going to be about 240 pounds an acre. Normally that's right around 20 grams of dry matter, which times 20 equals your 240 pounds per acre. So then you can start to guess if you do multipliers of that. So that's one thing that I do and I think about a lot is round big picture numbers to make sure you're on track for the long term. The other thing I do quite a bit is also a lot of rounding involved, but I take the classes of cattle I'm going to have and their estimated weight times 3%, and that's a dry matter basis also. That's daily forage requirements. Then multiply that however many head, whatever weight, times 0.03 is the pounds they're going to need per day, and look at that going forward. Like in the fall, that's a critical thing for us because we're looking at how much stockpile feed do we have available and what's that going to look like. This time of year, we're more looking and hoping precipitation is going to be a key player. But this time of year right now is probably the very most awkward time because it's really hard to zero in on what kind of forage growth you're going to have for the year. But you can estimate it and project it forward. And with a pretty short growing season here, from our perspective on it, with a cow-calf operation year-round, adding up all the different classes of livestock. And I would estimate by the end of July, our growing season is basically over. And at that point, I want to make sure that I've got well over a year's worth of forage standing. And I think that's where you're matching your what you think you're going to have for livestock versus the forage that you're going to have to use on a year-round basis. That doesn't mean you don't have some hay and some other things as buffers for that. But I think from a planning perspective, picking sometime that's at least midway through the growing season or towards the end of it is, and doing that estimate so you aren't getting, it's kind of like counting hay bales. That's what people do in a traditional model is you graze everything off and hay everything you can hay, and then you go count your hay bales, and then you decide how much you're going to buy or if you got any to sell. And it really, in a big picture, that really is what that amounts to. That's our perspective on that. I don't know if that really helps a lot when you're looking at how many you're trying to stock on ground that you're not at all familiar with. But I do think you can make irrigated ground is going to produce it at some level. Dry land is going to produce at some level. And also I do know that if you went into and talked to a range con from your area on dry land, you would certainly get some estimates. Somebody has been doing some clippings and they know what the production potential is. And from there, it's all management. How much do you want to leave and how much cover do you want to leave? How much you want to take each time? Do you want to do it twice? From there, there's all those considerations. But then twice over, if you're going to do irrigated ground and graze it two, maybe even three times in a year, that's the same basically the same thing as first, second, and third cutting, except you're probably not taking the total amount and you're probably leaving quite a bit more cover, but you'll get your two or three grazes and you can estimate by your weight class what that's going to amount to on a dry matter basis. And I always think one thing that I always think in pounds per acre, and I know a lot of people, and I've heard people at different things talking about stock days per acre. And I just started out thinking in purely in pounds per acre and pounds consumption, depending on the class of livestock and the weight. And I like to keep that in mind. And I guess in a couple of cases, I've heard people talking about, yeah, I got 50 stock days per acre off of that piece of ground. And so to me, that's a little bit almost like a competition. Like how many stock days per acre can you graze? I think that really misses the point, because we have to keep in mind that the big picture management is what's going to carry us through. It's not how much you can graze off that year. I mean, there are certain cases that might be. When you get to a dry year and you're looking at your total inventory, and you may say, if the market's down or whatever's going on, maybe we do want to graze this tighter than we had planned. But having those big picture numbers, so that as you whittle away at it and you're continually basically comparing that, so you know how much of your inventory you're taking away, I think that's critical thinking about as far as forward planning. And in most of Montana, with a pretty short growing season, certainly by the end of July, middle of August, I can't imagine hardly anybody on this call that doesn't pretty much know how much, wouldn't have the ability to know how much forage they're going to have available. And it's going to be a guess on how the growing season develops. And that can be, take common production from your area, extrapolate that out, and probably give yourself a 20 or 30% buffer, and you're more than likely safe. That's my guess for making those estimations. Is that making any sense?
Bart or Wyatt, do you want to kind of chime in and explain like how you guys do it too? And then we'll just open it up for questions and everybody can come back to you, Roger, if you want to add something or whatever, but would that work for you guys?
Go ahead, Wyatt.
Thanks, Bart. So I've found that telling Holly that you might possibly be a participant on a call is like me telling our church pastor that I could possibly help with a project. It means, oh, I guess you're going to do it. So I actually didn't have any, I haven't really prepared at all. I was out branding all day today, but I really appreciate Roger's thoughts and gives me a lot to go over on how we look at it. And we look at it a few different ways. One is we operate on several different ranches, and there's some ranches where we are running strictly a cow-calf enterprise, and then there's some ranches that we're running cow-calf and a stocker enterprise, and then there's some ranches that we're running where it's just strictly a stocker enterprise. And those strictly stocker enterprise ranches, we're looking at basically a 120 to 150 day grazing season. And then when we're running on our cow-calf enterprise, there really isn't a season. It's just based on a year-round grazing model. And so we need to be thinking a lot further ahead on those, for those enterprises and on those ranches, than we do on the ranches where we're just grazing a stocker enterprise, where it's just a defined season. So the planning and the execution look pretty different. The planning for a defined season with the stocker enterprise is, in my mind, a little more simple, but the execution is really critical. And I think to Roger's point about doing some sort of an appraisal midway through the season to see where you're at, that's something that we do on those ranches for sure, all the ranches, but the shorter season ranches, it's just really critical because we're trying to graze a ranch just right in a short season. So you don't have the luxury of maybe skipping a pasture and coming back to it for winter grazing if you didn't get to it, or just changing things up. Now, the ranches where we're grazing mostly cow-calf, the planning is difficult because you're thinking like 400 days in advance, it seems like, all the time. And that can be a little bit tricky to really figure that out, or it seems to me it is anyways. But the execution isn't quite as critical in that you've got more time on your hands. And you're making an evaluation midway through the season, say the end of July, like Roger was talking about. And we, at that point on the cow-calf side of things, we want to have enough grass to make it through until June or so the next year. And if you're a little short one way or the other, you don't have to change things quite as drastically as you would on that shorter season where, you know, you only have 60 days left in your season. So you got to either shorten your season or reduce numbers or something like that. So as far as how to measure it on our planning process, there's a few things that we have to know. And one would be our acreage. Acreage per pasture would be ideal. And then the other is some sort of an educated guess, or based on historical knowledge or through consulting with other people, of what the production of that pasture is going to be. And when we do talk about production and grazing, how much we're grazing, we actually do deal with pretty much strictly just stock days. And I think you could convert that fairly easily to pounds. I'm just assuming that maybe one stock day is 30 pounds of dry matter. I think that's a pretty safe guess. And then we just go on pounds of body weight. So the other one is you have to do a stock day factor for whatever class of animal you're grazing. And if we're grazing pairs in the summer, we're going to just go on total body weight of that cow-calf pair. So, you know, it might be 1,500 pounds, whereas a dry cow in the winter might be 1,200 pounds. So we'd be 1.2 stock days for those. And then the yearlings are basically just based on weight at turnout. So if they're 700 pounds and we turn them out and 900 pounds and we ship them off, we just adjust that rating through the season as we go. Just assuming a relatively consistent gain, we're probably going to load that to the front a little quicker, thinking that they're going to gain quicker just at the beginning of the season than they would be later in the season. A lot of our places, we've got quite a bit of historical data from grazing them for several years, and we know have a pretty good idea of what each pasture is going to yield depending on what our moisture conditions are. I would say if we don't have that information, a good just really rough guess for, I think, for native range anyways, and you could probably increase it a little bit for introduced, and then irrigated is going to be a different deal. But you can, I think, roughly guess one stock day per acre per inch of rainfall. And I'd love to get Trevor Smith's thoughts on this too, because he thinks ahead a lot on these things. And I think that's a pretty rough guess. And so if you're in a 12 inch rainfall area, I think you're somewhere around 12 could be close. And then that's a pretty good way to adjust it as you go through. If you just didn't get the rains you thought you were going to in the spring, but you don't really have any basis for what the pasture should look like in a normal year, or even what your normal precip might be, or if you're measuring your precipitation, I think you can do a decent job of guessing. And I would just probably err on the side of caution a little bit if you don't have that historical knowledge for stocking it. And especially if you're just dealing with a defined season, I think you want to give yourself a little bit of leeway there.
Bart, do you want to go and we'll see if we can get him back on?
Yeah, Natalie's going to.
I'll lead us off.
Yep.
And Bart will join in. So we just spent the last couple hours working on our grazing plan for the year and into next year, and it was really hard. Like Wyatt was saying, it's like there's all these unknowns and unpredictable factors, and we err on the side of caution and under calculating the forage in hopes that we'll be surprised that there's more forage. And so that kind of left us worried, oh, maybe there's not enough grass and we have to full feed for this many months. And that was the first time that I've ever done this. Wyatt, to hear you say that it is complex and time is on your side is helpful, because I was a little bit stressed after that. But basically I guess the main thing in calculating forage is whether your brain thinks in animal days per acre or in pounds per acre. And I, in like my short career, I've learned to measure grass in animal days per acre. So like when I look at a pasture, that's where my brain goes. And because I've worked for Bill and I know what a paddock there looks like, and how many ADAs are available before we graze it, and then what it looks like afterwards, that's been helpful in coming here and having my mind can look at different pastures and assess the ADAs. And then like after the cows are turned in and grazed and left, then I actually calculate it. And that's, I think I'm getting pretty good at guessing. And so that's the way that here at Oxbow that we assess is like going to the paddock and looking and using our eyes and all the training our eyes have gotten to guess how many ADAs. And then we know our animal units, and we know when we're going to put the cows in there. And so
we know our acres.
Yeah, we know our acreage. So all that's left is guessing the ADAs. We can use the equation to figure out how many days they'll be in there. And that's how we figured out our whole year grazing plan, is just like going back to Bart's historical data of what we got last year and what we got in years previous in that specific paddock. And then also taking into account rainfall for that year. That's a big component too. And then also something that's helpful for me in thinking in ADAs is like percent utilization. So I can think about what that paddock looked like when we left, and then put like in our grazing records, put a percentage that was taken. So like to Roger's point of people comparing ADAs, to me, like when I hear that we got 30 ADAs in this one paddock, I'm like, oh yeah, and we took everything. And that was really bad. That was a bad graze. And so if the 30 ADAs is paired with the 100% utilization, I know that 30 is way too high, even though that's what we got last year, versus if it's this sub-irrigated like front hay pasture and we're getting like 20 ADAs and 60, 70% utilization, I know that, and that it's like a 12-inch rainfall year. Like that is information that we can use that to predict for this growing season.
Yeah. The other piece of this that's super complex is like we run yearlings, finishers, and pairs. And so one of the things that we just did this afternoon that really helps us out with this ADA is standardizing that. And like we have an Oxbow standardization. We're not trying to fit anybody else's, because it works for us here. And so what we do is based on the year starting January 1st through December 31st, we'll go through and we'll standardize to accommodate for when those calves are growing on those cows. Just like Wyatt was talking about, if you have a 1100 pound cow and a 300 pound calf, that's 1400 pounds. And we have we account for that in our, and we standardize that. When we wean, which we don't know when we're going to wean every single year, but we have an idea of the time. We know that those animals those calves are going to leave that cow. They're going to move to yearlings, and our animal unit is going to drop to say 1.1 as opposed to where it was at 1.6. But I guess the story there is to, we have a table that shows us the standard, or we just developed a table that standardizes that. So we know the same every year. So we're not trying to, like every month, we're trying to increase those pounds on the deal. We just have it. It goes up in March. It goes up again in June. It goes up again whenever we have that standardized. So that's a big deal on us simplifying it so we can figure it out. And then what you guys were talking about mid-season, checking it and seeing where you're at on this is Natalie has, we have a spreadsheet that has our plan with all our ADAs and our pastures and where we're going and that. And then she is update every time we move, she updates the actual. So we know if we're ahead or if we're behind in that way. And so it's a running real time running deal. Like we either know we're hosed or we either know we're doing pretty good, and it'll change from time to time.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we just did that today. So our mother herd is in like 100, they're in 100-acre paddock, but we're using polywider to subdivide it. So like we're giving them, or we figured out that giving them 5 acres every 2 days is enough. And so even though there's still like 50 acres left, we can, while we're in the move, we can calculate our ADAs to figure out how much time is left. So it's not like after we pull them out, then we have to assess. Like we can still make that assessment while we're grazing.
Yeah. We gained what, 5 days today with them, which is huge.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And then another thing, maybe this is where I get really confused, if anyone has any insight, but like using, because I said my brain thinks in ADAs, and like in the fall going from ADAs to then all of a sudden starting to supplement with hay, and that's always like in pounds, that kind of gets funky for me. And so what we've been doing is figuring out how many, if we're just supplementing them like 8 pounds per head per day, then we reduce their animal units, is like how we figured out how to do that, to continue to think in ADAs. But what Roger was saying, if you are calculating everything in pounds per acre anyway, then just adding more pounds of hay, kind of those things make sense. Those are like parallel, but ADA is just conceptual thing that you have to learn, and then going to pounds of hay, it doesn't really compute for me.
Yeah.
I'd like to know if any of you have the grasshopper factor included in this. We lost all of our winter feed to the grasshoppers this year. Looks like we live in a desert.
We had 5 months of winter that we didn't account for, and we're not accounting for that same thing again next year. So we're just planning what is average or what is normal, and we're hopefully being conservative.
I think there's a lot of unknowns there. I don't think you can possibly plan for it all. I think if you planned for bad grasshoppers and a really nasty winter every year, then it would be pretty tough to make ends meet. I think you'd be able to take a little bit of risk, but not sink the ship in doing it either. We've certainly dealt with plenty of grasshoppers, and I know there's several people on this call that deal with them too. And that's one of those things where you just got to adjust it as you're going. I think maybe when you did your mid-season evaluation or your evaluation there at the end of July, didn't look too bad, but by the end of August, things are pretty well creamed. And I think you just have to adjust the same way you would if you were hoping to be able to graze out all winter, and you end up getting snowed under completely, even if you live in an area that generally doesn't do that. We've certainly dealt with that a few times, and a little to a certain degree this year did. whether it's adjusting by cutting numbers or supplementing feed or feeding more. You just have to run the numbers and figure out how to make it work.
I agree, Wyatt, with that. There's no way you're going to get every possible scenario, and you're always going to be off in your big picture estimate. There's going to be something. But having a buffer is part of what I think really makes the grazing system work, because you, on average or better than average years, I think having that buffer built in for cover is what really makes, is where the progress really comes from. And a little bit the flip side of that is we've had times when it looks like it's going to be dry. You think your estimates are, you're starting to err, and you're starting to err the wrong direction. And you can buffer that to some degree, but you got to really be careful, I think, because one way to buffer that is to increase your utilization. So if you'd estimated that you're gonna use, say, trample a third, use a third, and leave a third standing as an example, you're actually only calculating to use 33%. So you do have a 66% buffer in there that if you increase your utilization to 66%, you've actually doubled your what you can take. Now you're gonna compromise your cattle. And if you go to 80 or 90%, you're gonna really compromise your cattle. But sometimes when we've done that, we found that then the next year or two, if we give it adequate rest, that's where we get the best response. So that really high utilization at certain points, we found to be a very valuable tool. Of course, I don't think that's a wise policy with stockers, probably, is it, Wyatt? I don't know how you'd execute that, but we do have some flexibility with the pairs. I mean, there's some things you can do as long as it's not during breed up or prior to calving. There's some times when you can actually get a lot more mileage out of that. Then there's times when those cows really probably can get by on 2% or 2.5%. We've done some stuff with some dry cows where I'll bet it was less than 2%, but the utilization was probably 95%. And that results in being a real tool that we can use going forward. But you got to build that rest in sometimes 3 years or at least two following that. But to answer your question about the hoppers, that's hard, really hard to make happen.
I think another really valuable tool can be is to have multiple enterprises and rank them. And most of our places we have, maybe a cow-calf enterprise and a stocker enterprise. And if something unforeseen happens, whether it be hoppers, we can get one enterprise gone, and that's usually the yearlings. And so we can ship them early, or like this winter, for example, we winter quite a few calves on our ranch. And so basically all of the hay that we have is generally for the yearlings. But we got snowed under this winter and had to start feeding some cows. And so we just shipped calves to a grow yard. And that was just basically our built-in buffer. So that hay that was at our ranch, instead of going to calves, got shifted to cows. Now, still expensive, and you really got to run your numbers to make sure that is all going to work. And I think depending on the market situation, if it was different than it is right now, we might have made a different decision, but we thought that feed was worth it to keep our cattle inventory as high as we can, considering the value of those cattle.
The most priceless piece of this whole thing that what I'm hearing is that mid-season, the late season inventory. With us, it's a day-to-day inventory as we're going through it, or every time Natalie updates that. But because that gives you the real-time check, I guess, is what I'm hearing from Roger and Wyatt on the deal. And to me, that's the aha moment for me, is like knowing We predict, we guess, then you carry it out, and then you go back and double check. And if you're in trouble, if you're riding for trouble or not.
I do think Wyatt's really on to something with the, depending on the market, because, and from our perspective, if it's bulls and we decide to supplement them with substitute feed or other supplements, in a fairly short window, we're going to see the, we can basically make that a marketing cost. I know Wyatt and I had had that discussion about once you've decided to sell something, some of, a lot of the inputs are basically for marketing costs. It probably to some degree, Bart, same for you with cattle that you're finishing. But that's a lot easier to do when the market's moving up than it is when it's moving down. And yeah, I just think playing that game a little bit with looking at the market to assist in making those decisions. And even that, the market for the cattle as well as the market for the feed. So there's two sides of that equation. Would you be ahead to maybe it should be really understocking in a low market and selling the feed? Because there's somebody who is not doing the math and will pay too much for it. And, you know, I guess playing those different angles are important.
Do any of you guys figure pounds per inch of rain?
I think that stock days per inch of rainfall is similar, Trevor, as far as what's produced in the pasture. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you used it to plan, you know, going forward.
I think, or I guess the way that has been introduced to me is like a tool to measure carrying capacity of like your entire ranch. But I don't think we really use it. But the a light bulb moment for me was what Wyatt said of like in the rainfall in your area is what is standard. And that is, we got exactly, or our average ADA last year was exactly our average rainfall here, which is cool.
Because I guess what I've found, I've tracked the stock days per acre, per inch of rain, and the pounds per acre. And it all basically balances out. But what I've found is if I'm going to get average moisture for this year, at least I have a pretty good idea of how many pounds I'm going to grow. Because we grow 90 pounds per inch of rain. So you can put that to 3 stock days per acre. So that at least gives me an idea of right now if I'm looking at my deal, we're actually behind on our stock days produced as of May 1st. So that's how I think about it.
What do you mean you're behind, Trevor, as far as how much grass you've grown so far this season or how many stock days you've taken in the past? Or
no, basically I'm constantly rolling my figure. I should have, on average, have grown at least 1 stock day by now, and I've only grown a quarter of a stock day, basically, according to the amount of rainfall.
Okay. So your assumption is that you're going to grow 90 pounds per inch of rainfall, and you just haven't had the rainfall. So you're not assuming that you're growing less per inch of rainfall. You're just assuming you just haven't had the rain.
Yeah, exactly. It's all a function of rain. You're probably growing more, but yeah.
Might have to call your yearling guy and cut some numbers, huh?
Yeah. I'm
when you talk about the pounds per inch of rain, I'm assuming that varies depending on whether it's native or tame or what the crop, if it's forage.
Yeah, we just have pretty much all native. We have a few crested wheat fields, but yeah, it's for the most part native, and it's kind of an average over the ranch. There's some places that are only probably 50 pounds, and then others are probably 120. So it's just a kind of an average.
And Wyatt, on the pounds or stock days per inch of rain, have you noticed having to calibrate differently if you experience successive heat? above normal temperatures for, let's just say, June, when things are growing and it's really hot for a period of time. Do you have to back that off, or does that remain constant?
I think that's a really good point, Andrew. I think the heat does have a lot to do with it also. And I don't know, we certainly don't have a system in place to account for that other than just flying by the seat of our pants like we do, it seems like, most of the time anyways, but be like, it's really hot and how much good are we actually getting out of this, the moisture that we've received? And another good example is we theoretically had quite a bit of moisture this winter, but most of it ran down the creek on top of frozen ground 10 days ago. And it's, in our mind, basically didn't get much good out of any of that moisture. We feel like we could use a shot of rain right now, even though theoretically we're kind of a little bit ahead of schedule on how much moisture we've received. So I think there's variables like that, just like the hopper variable or anything. This is, it's so fluid. There's a lot to it. And that's where the maybe almost more art than science part of it comes in, I think. Just, and every ranch is different too, so.
Yeah, and I agree totally with Wyatt said that kind of the odd thing we had happen last year was we had a 2.5-inch rain in July, and that just threw my precipitation off. But I actually don't think we grew the grass, so my figures are probably skewed. It's just how pretty more art than science, I think.
I think, Trevor, I would agree with that, because I think depending on when rainfall comes, there's a different value to it. Of course, it's always valuable, but it's certainly going to grow different amounts of feeds per inch. But I still really think there's value in a rolling 12-month average. And I think from a big picture perspective, if you combine a rolling 12-month average precipitation with planning, like Wyatt was talking about, 365 to 400 days forward, I think those are the things that then build in a buffer that allows you to at least mitigate hoppers or dry weather coming, because you should recognize that if you've got a 12-month rolling average on your precipitation, and that's starting to steadily go down for 2 or 3 months in a row, indications are that your next year, you better start thinking about what your inventory is going to look like a year from now. And especially if we go back to a little more of an overall ecological land planning process of what is best for the underground livestock, rather than just how much can we use above ground. I think then you start to get a little bit more of a complete projection. And that's for cases where you're doing a high utilization on an area that you think can stand it or that needs it, can help you to buffer that as well. So those are just some random thoughts, but yeah.
I think that rolling average is pretty valuable, Roger. And we've actually started measuring, so a rolling 12-month average, and then a rolling 24-month average, and a rolling 36-month average. So 1, 2, and 3 years. Mm-hmm. And I think that's been pretty interesting to monitor too, because, you know, the 12 months is, that's your topsoil in my mind. The two-year average, and certainly the three-year average, that's probably your subsoil there. And you can get by with a dry year, like in 2020, for example. That was a pretty dry year, but we got by pretty well. And I think mostly because we were living off the subsoil moisture that we put in 2018 and 2019. But then that 2 and 3 year average started to go down. And now we're almost a little bit the other way, where our 12 month average is actually close to average, but that 36 month average is by far the lowest it's ever been since we've, I think we've got 25 years of data in this And that 36-month average is still by 8 inches lower than it's ever been. So we still feel like we're just completely hand-to-mouth, even if we have, you know, an above-average year. I think it just takes a while to turn that ship around. And that's all just factors that go into trying to figure this all out. Just a lot to it.
I have a question for all of you guys. It's a little bit not so detailed, a little bigger picture. As I listen to all of you, the remarkable amount of moving parts that everybody is playing with in the present moment and historically, their experience and everything. We talk about regenerative agriculture and resilience, and we often think we're actually trying to make our land more resilient or more regenerative. As I listen to you guys and knowing how people's production has really been quite volatile over the last 2 or 3 years, at least in our part of the world, my question to you, do you think your resilience is your experience or your land? Is it what's in your head and what you practiced, or is it what you actually think you're doing to your ground?
I don't know that it's an either or, Bill. I think resilience, and I know Andrew and I have talked about this quite a bit too, but resiliency is multi-layered. So it's your, I mean, it's all your resources. It's your ecological resources. It's your human resources. It's your financial resources. It's just this whole package that everybody's situation is completely unique. And I think some good introspection with everybody, with all of our businesses, to see where maybe the weak spots of our resiliency is. And I think that can help as we move forward. But I think it's all of it. That's part of, we talk about regenerative agriculture, but holistic management is, it's all of those pieces. And I think that all, if we're working on all of those factors, I think that's going to increase our resiliency.
Yeah, I'd love to hear from the others. That was a great response. Curious how you
experience doing this. I agree with Wyatt. I think that there's a lot of things in play, but I'm not sure our experience versus the land. I think it's all such a small piece of time that we're affecting it, honestly. I think that the actual resilience to most of these landscapes is way bigger than we are, so that we can certainly play with it. We can make mistakes. And I think overall, in my judgment, is just try to enhance that and not try to make that balance to the positive and not too much to the negative. And I think there's without a doubt, in my mind, at least, that one of the principles, which is the rest, is that then you got to balance all the economic and all the other things that lead to resiliency that Wyatt was talking about. But to me, the bigger of a buffer you can build, of a forage buffer, leads towards more resilience in the land from all factors, whether that's precipitation, markets, or whatever, because anytime you have extra forage, it's very marketable, at least in today's market. So I don't see that as too big of a limiting factor, because forage is very marketable. And we try to have a pretty good substantial buffer.
Thanks.
I guess for us, it's, Bill, looking at it is, I think we're short on the experience end of things here, because we're first generation, first time doing this, first time all this. And so our experience is really limited in what we're doing. And I guess, to be honest with you, I don't think we have any resilience. We're trying to develop that. We're trying to build that here. We're trying to do that through the experience of listening to folks that have been there, done that. But when I think we don't have any of that built in, is I think it comes down to the economics of it first and foremost for us. Because one guy told me that we leased from, we gave him a good presentation and had a great mission and all that. And he said, told me four words, and he goes, no margin, no mission. So no matter how hard, no matter what we want to do good with the land or how hard or what, or yeah, no matter what good we want to do, we can't do it unless we make some money at it while we're doing it. And so that is definitely a piece of the resiliency that we have to build in. And by, we haven't dialed that by far. We have not. I don't think we've dialed the resiliency in this land at all. We're pretty reactionary to what's happening, and maybe that'll be that way the rest of our lives. And that's where the deal we did with Natalie today, and that she's built the Excel spreadsheet. For the first time, I'll feel more proactive than I've ever been on this deal. And then like a buffer of forage, we rest parts of the place every year trying to be the best stewards of the land, but that isn't a, we don't have any buffer of forage either. The only buffer we have is the amount of the animals that we can sell and market, pretty much is all we have. But then that always comes back to the economics of it. I don't know if that answers your question or not, because it's pretty much clueless.
I definitely agree with all that and what everyone has said, but like, to me, the little tiny things that we can do that makes me feel like I am contributing to some resiliency of the land is like fencing out the cattails, like for the blackbirds, or fencing out this riparian area so the cows don't muck it all up, or just doing little things like that I think do have a visible effect, and maybe, I guess, stacked up might have a bigger effect in the long run.
Yeah, thanks everyone. And Bart, I wouldn't sell yourself short. I think we're all, and I think that sometimes to me, just being able to participate in a bull session and share the experience of multiple people, it's about that, it's probably the most useful investment of time that one can make, because none of us can experience all these things at the same time, at the same place. But yeah, good stuff. Good to know it's not easy.
I certainly agree with Natalie, and I believe that the small things are just as, what you're saying are small things, Natalie. I think our experience says that we thought they were small things. They're not small things. They're very important things. And without a doubt, there's a compounding effect that those have, and lays the groundwork basically for a bit of a mindset is in preserving some of that, some of those ecological things that you can build on. I think in a way that is a buffer in and of itself, just the fact that you're doing those things. And I certainly wouldn't underestimate it. And however small it seems on a certain day, there is a compounding effect.
I'm in the background here, but Roger and everyone, can you talk about what you do when, like, when you're partway through the season and you realize, hey, you way overestimated. Just what are your first steps? What do you think about? What do you do? Does that make sense? What I'm asking?
Overestimated.
How many animals you could run, or what your forage production was, so that, or what you thought it was going to be that year. That process.
For us, well, if that's the case, like if we hit July and we're burning through grass way faster than we thought, at that point in time, it becomes the market. And the way the market's going right now, the first thing we would look at is our yearlings. That's our, and I mean, it's your drought plan. Our yearlings are our drought plan. And those, like last year, we sold part of them just because by the time we hit this time of year, we already knew we were in trouble. And so, if our estimates are gone, Natalie will put up a red flag and say, we're not hitting our ADAs like we thought. We're way ahead. We're way behind, whichever way.
I don't know.
We'll market those yearlings, I guess, at that point in time. That'd be the first thing we'd do. The other thing we'd look at considering is if pairs are going through for a bunch more money, we'd look at culling our mama herd and potentially selling pairs that don't fit.
I think that's a really good point, Bart. I guess what we do is we start looking at, you know, we need to have less cattle. You just try to figure out whether you have pasture cattle that you brought in that maybe you can talk to the cattle owner and see if they could go somewhere else, or you have yearlings or cows. But to Bart's point, really looking at the market, and we have this paradigm that, yeah, our yearlings are our drought buffer, but there are times that maybe it makes more sense to sell the cow, depending on what their value is relative to the market. I don't hear for the next year or so, or two or three, I don't know how long, but that's definitely going to be a consideration. I think these cow values are going to get very high. Now, whether they're overvalued or not is a tricky one to figure out, but yeah, that's a good point.
So it might be a function of what kind of business you're in partially, because for us, the cow herd on a seed stock operation seems like it hurts a lot to try to sell a cow herd, but there certainly is replacement heifers and those kind of thing that we can do things with. We could haul bulls to a grow yard or something. So we have a couple options that way. But the very first place I would look in our operation is a fair percentage of flood irrigated grazing land. And so I might go to that grazing plan and say I had anticipated on each graze that I was doing 30% consumption, 33% consumption, and 33% trampling, and 33% standing. So I might say, what if I take all those acres and increase that utilization to 60%? How far does that get me? Because I think the resilience of the land on the irrigated ground, at least that's maybe gives you a 1 year buy, possibly. And if you have good, steady irrigation water, I think that's a fairly substantial buffer that is built in beyond precipitation and beyond. So I guess it depends on the whole mix, I guess is what I'm saying, and what the main part of the business is it moves your priorities as to where you think you might make up that difference. Yeah.
Thanks, everybody.
I got a question. So my wife and I, we don't own any hay equipment. We live in Southwest North Dakota. We are pretty new to the grazing game. The best we've done is only fed hay for 2 months. This last winter's kind of wrecked us pretty hard on that. But is there an amount of hay that you guys figure on keeping around the place? When we're purchasing hay, I guess every year we're just trying to figure out, is there a sweet spot in there where we're not overcommitting ourselves to all this capital that we would invest in hay versus having to buy it last minute when the market's rallying? It's just something we've really been trying to pencil in, I guess, if you guys had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, Sean, I guess I'll tell you what we do. So when we wean calves, we're going to assume that we're going to have to feed those calves, that our stockpile forage probably isn't good enough for them for a while till we get green grass. And we're going to wean calves somewhere in January, probably around the end of January, calving in May. But we're going to figure on higher quality hay to buy for those calves or to have around for those calves. That can be buffered to some degree with some cake or some other kind of feed as well. But you're still going to provide for those calves until they get to green forage or a good growing forage. I don't think there's any way really around that. I don't imagine we grow enough or have enough quality enough
stockpile forage at that time of year to really provide for them. Then when you get to the cow herd, we figure that we need to plan to feed for 1 month, which would be probably January, while the calves are on those cows. If we get very much weather, we may very well need to feed for that. So that's, say, 30 days at 30 pounds. If we know we have the stockpile forage. And then after that, if it's just winter weather events in February, March, and April, I would estimate another, as far as a buffer I'd like to have on hand, would be another month, 3 weeks to a month, which still at 30 pounds per head per day. But the good thing about that is that can be equal to the quality of your standing forage or of your stockpile forage. In other words, really poor hay. You want it poor enough to where they really want to go graze when you feed them. And so you can buy that a lot more economically, whether that's straw that you put some Lumix on, or there's lots of options to mitigate that and keep that as a cheaper buffer. But I don't see a way to cut the corner for the forage quality on the weaned calves.
I think this number comes close to what Roger's saying, but, and I haven't figured it up this year because I'm not sure we're quite done, but since we moved to the spring calf, the May calving, we've been in that, instead of figuring 2 ton per head per year, it's been a lot closer to 3/4 of a ton. And as I was listening to your numbers, Roger, I think that's pretty close to where maybe where you're landing.
Right. Yep. Pretty close.
But, and we've drastically decreased the amount of hay we put up. So what is there for the cows is generally pretty decent hay. And so it's more of a supplement to whatever they're out there picking up. And I guess they just get used to, this is what you're getting, you better go find the rest. But if they can get a little protein boost out of what I take them, then they can go out and pick up whatever. But like you say, you can, whether it's straw and Lumix or distiller's grains or cake, whatever it is, to give them that little bit of protein boost so they can go and utilize that rough feed.
We do pretty similar, roughly would like to have 3 or 4 weeks of hay on hand that's designated for cows. One ranch that's just strictly a cow-calf operation, that's might be cutting it a little close and putting ourselves at risk of what you were talking about, Sean, as far as needing to buy hay when demand for hay is high and supply is low, and that gets pretty expensive. But like on a ranch here in Melville, we're always going to have hay, and we're pretty much always going to be feeding hay to something. So the way we get around that is if we feed more. And so because we know that, we're just trying to get the best buy we can. So sometimes we're forward contracting it. Other times we're leaving ourselves open to the market a little bit. But then all we do is just, depending on the conditions, we're just adjusting what class we're feeding that to. So like this year, for example, we shipped some calves to a grow yard and fed more of that hay to those cows. So we didn't actually end up buying any more hay this year. And so we didn't have to expose ourselves to that market, a short-term blip, but we did have to buy more feed for calves that we weren't planning on. So that there's still a cost there.
Our goal is to feed for 2 months. We missed that mark big time this year. One of the things we did for the first time and was, because what we do is we try to buy real high quality alfalfa and then use that as our protein supplement on stockpiled forage. And so what we ended up having this year was we were feeding really high quality alfalfa full feed to these cows forever. And so we ended up buying some straw from out of Washington and feeding that. And it seemed like it made the cows happier, but we I talked to a guy that was feeding straw and gave me an idea on that. But if anybody has more ideas on alternative feed source or feed stuff, because we don't put up any hay, we buy it all. So it comes down to us. It's just a pure financial deal. It's like, we know how much money we have to buy hay based on the number of cows and based on how much we're planning on. And if we don't hit that mark, it cuts into next year's money is the way it is. So alternative feed stuff, and we can't feed any grains, or we got to stay away from sugars and all that based on the way we sell our cows.
Thank you.
We do feed quite a bit of hay to cows, and that's a lot of times that's what we have on hand for them. If we know we've got some set aside just for them, and we'll supplement that with cake, and we've gotten by, would say, pretty well with that.
You guys all lease ground, all of you. Do you ever lease more than you think you'll need? Stockpiling straw or whatever, that it seems like none of our ranches are really whole in themselves. We all seem to require some partnership on something. But can you ever play with just making sure you have outlets to, tie up grass that maybe you won't need, maybe you will?
We have the opportunity potentially to do that right now, Bill. And the first thing in my mind goes is, how can I make money off that and put cows on it? And what you're saying is maybe the best way to make money on that is to not put anything on it, or put something on it and save my stuff here. Is that what you're getting at?
You're putting a price on. Every one of you relies at some level on some type of stockpile feed. And so then you put a price on a variety of things that could create stockpiled opportunities that you could actually use and protect the stuff you know you have at home. So you might say, yeah, I'm going to go here, knowing that I can come back here. But maybe I don't need it. But then it seems like we're never in a situation, by having a little extra stockpile feed at home, never becomes a liability. Because stockpile feed, even if it's not grazed, well, you can't ungraze it for too long, but you just grow more feed under stockpile feed, just as a matter of course. So sometimes when you have more, it can really grow feed in a dry situation. We experienced that in the last couple of years. But I don't know. I'm just curious, because you all are, many of us, and you guys in particular, are always trying to secure grass somewhere else. And I'm just curious if you ever think, find people that can secure grass and save your own, it might not work, might not, versus buying hay or buying straw or stuff like that.
You're always just trying to build a little bit of margin into it and try to be able to do that economically. There's just this trade-off. How much hay do you want to have on hand? So if we figure that we're going to lease this ranch and we're going to try to have 14 months worth of grass plus a month worth of hay, then yeah, we're essentially leasing more land than we need, because we've got a grazing plan that can take us through 12 months of grazing out if conditions allow, but we've also got a month of hay sitting on hand, and we've intentionally tried to build in maybe another 20% of margin just in case we're missing the mark with our grazing planning. I think that's, whether you're buying hay that you might not feed or you're leasing grass that you might not have to use, it's all just building margin one way or the other. It seems
like you can talk about building margin. The price of that lease gets cheap when you realize that you're stockpiling $250 feed that you don't have to go out and buy and unroll at home. And I don't think, I doubt there's anybody here that has a problem with that math. It's more about the supply of the lease ground than anything.
I think that's right. I think that comes into play too. And we've certainly leased ground that we did not need.
for the cattle we had on hand that day. But we've also leased ground that we ended up paying basically that whatever we estimated the stockpile potential of that ground, we just used the price of hay. And all of a sudden, that pushes that market a little bit higher, because if you're looking at leasing the ground and for summer grass versus winter grass, if you did the math on what a cow eats per day and divided that by $250 or $300 a ton and told somebody you had a lot of summer grass, that you'd sell them for $100 a month.
Summer or winter?
They're going to laugh at you. But if you tell them you're going to get $250 a ton for hay, they buy it. So, yeah, we've done different assortments of that. And I think depending on where it's at, sometimes geographical separation is a good thing.
So I want to thank all my speakers tonight. Wyatt, I do apologize. You give an inch, boy, and I'm going to take a mile. We just got to remember that next time. But I do appreciate you all coming on. And this has been really good. I've loved the back and forth banter and the questions. And so we'll definitely resume this next fall. So I appreciate you all for tuning in.